Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
That's all I did.
Here's John Williams.
This weekend, hi. This is John Williams. We're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. We're here weekdays till 3 o'clock, and we appreciate your tuning in as well. Don't forget, Saturdays are on from 12 a.m. until 10 a.m. until noon. And don't miss the Mincing Rascals podcast, the podcast we record in the studios of WGN Radio on Thursdays, judged the best podcast in the city of Chicago. We asked you over the weekend, so many stories moving in so many different directions so quickly right now. Tribune columnist and Mincing Rascals fellow podcaster Eric Zorn has been wondering, how confident are you that Christine Blasey Ford is telling the truth? And it's what they call an inverted bell-shaped curve, I think. That is, all the answers are on the extremes, not many in the middle. 77% of you are very confident, 80 to 100%, that she's telling the truth. And 13% of you, the next largest group, don't believe her at all. So you have a lot of people that do believe her, some people that don't, and not many of you are in the middle, kind of wishy-washy about this. We'll talk more about that story today and, of course, this week. We do have a new news click at WGNradio.com. We'll post it on my Facebook page, too. I'm WGN King John on social media. Producer Elif, what is the news click today, please?
You are Rod Rosenstein. What would you do? A. Quit. B. Wait to be fired. C. Change my identity. Flee the country.
Threw that last one in there for you. By the way, it's Rosenstein, I think. Producer Elif, double-check that,
apologies,
please.
John.
Thank you. I may be wrong. I've been saying Blasey Ford, and it's Blasey Ford, so don't consider me the best source on these sorts of things. But I think
okay.
I think it's Rosenstein. Somewhere along the line, I envisioned having a beer with Rod Rosen, a stein of beer. We're drinking a stein of beer. We're just throwing back, having a swell time, couple of guys watching the games. Me and Rod Rosenstein. That's how I remember it. But again, I may be remembering.
I think of Frankenstein.
Well, there's that too. There you go. I'm the assistant attorney general. Ah. I'm Franken Rosenstein. Not for long. Of course, the reporting on that's been all over the map. Steve, where are we on the he is out?
He's going to have the White House says that he and the president will meet on Thursday.
Okay.
The earlier reporting was that he was heading to the White House with the expectation of being fired. Mm-hmm. The president has not been in the room for other high-profile firings in the administration, and he's in New York for the United Nations today, so maybe it was put off so that he could be in the room. I don't know.
But as we stand here now, Rosenstein is still the assistant attorney general. He is the decider on a lot of things about the Mueller investigation, and he has not lost his job, nor has he quit yet.
As far as we know, that's correct. I mean, there were reports that he had.
Yeah.
I saw one report that they had actually been negotiating his departure through the weekend, but the two sides couldn't agree, so I don't really know.
Would you quit or would you wait and be fired? I would wait to be fired. But that's just me. Maybe you'd say, oh, screw it, I'm out of here. It just seems to me like if you want to make a statement with your departure, better that the onus is on the other person. If you capitulate, well, then that's on you. Better that you force their hand. Well, they fired me. So now they have to make an explanation. You see how that works? I follow a lot of people on Twitter, of course, and one of them tweeted this. If you're just joining us, Rod Rosenstein has resigned, but also hasn't resigned yet, and is going to the White House in order to resign and also to be fired. And also he's already been fired and is already gone and also isn't resigning or getting fired. Now back to you. Yeah, that's kind of the way it's been. Meanwhile, in Chicago, the Jason Van Dyke trial continues. I am very surprised at the way this is going. Our Eric Rung has been covering it for WGN Radio. Hi, Eric.
Good afternoon, John. We are at a lunch break now. Some very intense questioning, cross-examination of Jason Van Dyke's first witness, who was a forensic pathologist. It was Dr. Saku Tease. And basically, her testimony to the jury today during direct examination was that it was only one shot that killed Laquan McDonald, and that was the shot to his chest. She called many of the other wounds, you'll remember he was shot 16 times, she called many of those other wounds superficial. Now, as I said, it was a really intense cross-examination from the state, and at one point it was very impactful. The prosecutor got up and went through each one of the shots with the defense's pathologist. And what she did was she said, how about shot number one? Did that cause an injury to Laquan McDonald? And the doctor said, yes. How about shot number two? Did that cause an injury to Laquan McDonald? Yes. And she did that 16 times. Although went through every single one of those shots. Now, so far, the doctor has been the only one to testify on behalf of Jason Van Dyke. We understand that the defense is likely to call three witnesses today. We understand also that the defense did have several expert witnesses that they wanted to call to refute, obviously, that video that we've all seen so many times. We also understand that the defense has commissioned its own video animation using measurements from that night that is supposedly going to give us the view that Jason Van Dyke had of Laquan McDonald.
So the defense has their doctor up there, and she is trying to say that only one shot killed Laquan McDonald and the other 15 were not fatal?
She said that there was possibly the one to his neck could have caused him to die. However, she said that since they did the tracheotomy, she couldn't say that for certain. When they were trying to revive him, emergency workers opened up his breathing tube or put a breathing tube down his throat to see if they could resuscitate him. The other thing that kept coming up here again and again was the time of death. Now, the doctor said on direct examination from Van Dyke's attorneys that there is no way that Laquan McDonald could have survived more than 5 minutes after taking a shot to the chest, the one that she said was the fatal one. Of course, the prosecution throughout this case has maintained that Laquan McDonald did in fact have a pulse when emergency workers got there and had a pulse in the ambulance, lost that pulse, but doctors did try to resuscitate him once he did get to the emergency room that night. Again, the time of death playing a big role in the testimony here today.
Eric, I've been watching it on TV. You've been sitting there. You have an even better vantage point than we do. But the way I'm following it is that the defense is trying to say, look, he may have been shot 16 times, and that sounds egregious, but only one or two of the shots were fatal. That is, if they really felt like they had to subdue this man, you had numerous injuries. The state continues to make that point, but none of them would have been fatal. Only one, maybe two shots actually ended his life. So it's not as awful as it sounds. And we have doctors that are maybe disagreeing on their interpretation of this. And we have the two sides kind of disagreeing on the presentation of this. And it got kind of testy between this doctor. Can you give me that name again? It's
Saku Tease is her name. She used to work at the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office. She's done thousands of autopsies.
Right.
That's who was testifying today. Yeah, no, you're dead on, John, and your take on what is happening here today. The one other big contentious point between the state and Dr. Tease was during direct examination by Van Dyke's attorneys, the doctor had said that the only way that Laquan McDonald could have received a gunshot wound to the chest where it was if he was facing Jason Van Dyke, which, of course, the defense has said over and over again that the video doesn't show Jason Van Dyke's perspective. And, of course, we heard his partner from that night say that Laquan McDonald did, in fact, turn toward them and raise the knife above his head. Of course, you don't see that on the video, and that's part of the part of the issues that the defense is having in this case. However, that became a big point of contention between the doctor and the state's attorney, because the state's attorney in this case, or the special prosecutor, I should say, in this case, said over and over again, you know, what you're saying that this is the only way he could have gotten shot in the chest. That's not accurate, right? And I'm paraphrasing here. And she said, well, no, his torso had to be facing him, so he wasn't facing him straight on like we're facing each other. And they went back and forth on that for probably a good two to three minutes before the doctor said, no, he was not facing straight on like you and I are facing straight on. They were looking right at each other as she stood at the podium. She was in the witness box there.
I can play that audio for you here in just a second, but this is what it's coming down to. Think about that. There's no question that Van Dyke fired. There's no question that Laquan McDonald died. I'm surprised that there's this much importance on exactly when and exactly where. How does that matter? And honestly, I'm not even that interested in how many bullets were fatal and how many shots he received. Van Dyke shot McDonald. Now the question is, did he have to? And maybe what you're describing now becomes critical. Was he turning at him? Was he presenting this sinister, dangerous look or not? So they get into this big conversation about where does the torso begin? Oh, it begins at the shoulders and below and goes down to the pelvic area. So when we say he turned, does that mean his head turned or his torso turned? And I mean, I'm telling you that this is was a very important and contentious part of the testimony.
It's not evidence of Laquan McDonald facing the officer straight on, is it?
I never said straight on.
No, Ben, could you please answer the question?
Objection. Define straight on.
Well, you testified.
You and I are straight on. No, it wasn't like that.
Okay. It was with his body turned to him, correct?
It was with his torso turned to him.
I'm thinking if I'm a juror and I'm sitting there listening to this, I'm getting frustrated, maybe with both sides, and maybe this is all the defense has. But so if I'm a juror, I'm saying, okay, I see the video. Was his torso and his head turned or not? How long was he facing them? They're deliberating about this, Eric.
Yeah, I mean, the entire defense rests on the fact of whether or not Jason Van Dyke felt as if he was threatened by Laquan McDonald that night. That's what it all comes down to. And any time that the defense has an opportunity to say that Laquan McDonald turned toward Jason Van Dyke, they are going to take that opportunity. Now, again, you know, as far as the jury goes, you know, they're taking all of this in after taking in a lot of medical talk pretty much a lot of the morning, and then you get to this very contentious part of the case, and you can tell, you can feel it. You can feel it when tensions rise in there.
Yeah.
And they're going to really have to take all of this into consideration, obviously, but the defense is going to take every opportunity they can to say that Laquan McDonald faced him, whether it be his torso, his eyes, or his feet. It doesn't make any difference. Anytime they have a chance to say that, they are going to. And the doctor presented them with an opportunity today, and they took it. Now, the state did go after her, and they went after her hard. That questioning was very intense today from the prosecution. It was probably some of the most contentious testimony we've seen, other than Jose Torres, who was the last witness for the prosecution,
right,
that said, yeah, which was back and forth between the defense attorney and himself about what he saw that night. And he said he did not see Laquan McDonald turn anywhere but toward that chain link fence that we see in the video.
All right, Eric Rungs at the courthouse. We'll continue to follow it via you. Check back in later on if something else happens that we need to know right away. And otherwise, we'll visit with you later this week, Eric. Thanks for your time.
Sounds good, John. Thanks.
You bet. It just seems to me that if Rosenstein were serious, there would have been a whole bunch of other steps to follow up about how they would actually wiretap the president, how they would wire up Rosenstein, what are the machinations of the 25th Amendment. It's complicated and virtually impossible. If it was anything but a joke, then some of that stuff would have been explored. There's no reporting that any of that was happening, but Obviously, the president's very upset about that, or at least that's what it seems to be. And the reason that Rosenstein issued two statements over the weekend was because the first was not deemed forceful enough. So the second one came out to say, no, for goodness sakes. He didn't say for goodness sakes. But it was to reinforce what he had tried to make clear earlier, that he was not thinking about looking down the path to the 25th Amendment. Dave Schultz is a professor of politics at Hamline University. He's also the author of Presidential Swing States, and he's joined us before on constitutional matters. Dave, welcome back to the show. How are you?
Good, and thank you for having me, of course.
You agree with my analysis that, I mean, it sure reads like a one-off to me?
It is. The 25th Amendment, there are four parts to it. Three parts are easy to figure out, which deal with what happens if the president dies or if there's a vacancy with the vice president. But the part that everybody's thinking about is the fourth article of the 25th Amendment, which has never actually been invoked, and it is not easy to understand.
And I don't think it's even in play here, but just satisfy my curiosity. How would it happen?
Okay. So what would happen here is, let us say that the vice president and the cabinet officials thought for some reason that the president was incapacitated, you know, cognitively or physically in some way, and unable to perform duties. If they do a majority vote, they then send a letter to the head of the Senate and the Speaker of the House indicating that they think that the president is no longer able to perform his duties and that the vice president's going to take over. Once that letter is sent, then the president can send a letter within 4 days, and the president can say, no, I'm fine, I can do my job, et cetera, et cetera. Then, if the vice president and the cabinet still believe that the president is incapacitated, they have to send another letter to the Speaker of the House and President Pro Temp saying, no, we mean it, and we're taking over. Then, Congress would have 21 days at that point to vote to remove the president from office and institute the vice president.
The first hurdle, I mean, all of those are, you know, virtually insurmountable and not very viable right now, given the makeup of the Congress. But it seems to me like the first hurdle is maybe the greatest. This is a president who, like all presidents, appoints people to the cabinet that support him, and it sure does seem like they do these days, regardless of what he says or does. And then the vice president, who is, in my estimation, adoring of this president. So So to get Mike Pence and a majority of the cabinet to say, Mr. President, we don't think you're competent, when the market is at 26,576 points, that ain't going to happen. That just is not going to happen, Dave.
I absolutely agree with you that I think it would be very difficult under these circumstances, and that's the whole idea. It is not supposed to be easy. It's not supposed to be a situation where cabinet members disagree with the president philosophically or politically, or they're out to try to orchestrate some kind of coup or something like that.
Yeah.
Even though we do have an electoral college that ultimately picks the president, at least some way, shape, or form, the people get to make a choice in terms of who they want as president, and it shouldn't be easy to remove presidents in midterm.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I absolutely agree with you on that. And I guess this back and forth between them and the president is, the president can say, yeah, okay, you know what, you guys, I haven't been eating right. I haven't been sleeping. I'm going through a marital spat, or I'm having an emotional breakdown, and you know what, you guys are right. I need to step down. But he's got 4 days to sort of assess that before he either acquiesces or fights it, huh?
You're absolutely correct. And in that time, as long as he writes a letter to Congress and says, it could just be, I'm assuming it could be one sentence that says, I intend to perform my duties as President of the United States.
Right.
Sincerely, Donald Trump. That's enough. That's at that point. I come back to it. Even though we've heard for the last 18 months or 20 months, some people who don't like the president jumping up and down saying 25th Amendment, 25th Amendment. No, it really has to be something serious, not just simply disagreeing, and requires those people who are closest to him to make that call. And yes, they are loyalists, but at the same point, you have to hope that their loyalty extends to what the United States, and saying that if they thought that the president really did have major problems. And again, it could be a situation where we could speculate here. Let's say you're right. Let's say, president because of a loss of a loved one is suddenly very, very depressed but doesn't realize it. You know, maybe a situation like that, or I don't know, a ski injury. I'm just trying to come up with something here, but it's supposed to be very difficult.
The next question then, Dave Schultz on a phone line. He's the author of Presidential Swing States. He's a constitutional scholar and a professor of politics at Hamline University. Let's pause. We're going to do the news, Dave. I'll just ask you to answer one question afterwards, and that is, so then what does happen if the president dismisses Rosenstein? How much power does he have to appoint his successor? Are there any political or constitutional complications here? Steve, we just posted to WGNRadio.com a video and a flip-through picture-by-picture story of Violetta and Elif and my trip to the Amazon Go store.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story about this in the New York Times today, too.
About your trip to the Amazon Go store?
About the fact that the one in Chicago is the only other one in the country outside of Seattle.
Right.
And then they list a bunch of other interesting business initiatives that Amazon has. What an interesting company. And so we went there to show you what it's like. And the pros and the cons of this new store. The video is right on our front page at WGN.
Any of you try to sneak something out? Because that's really the question we all have.
Well, you feel like you are when you go there. You feel like you're sneaking something out because, remember, there's no cashiers at the new Amazon store. It just knows what you took.
I guess I was asking Violetta because she's most likely the one who...
Excuse me. Actually, John put his chips in my bag.
I thought, well, then now she has to pay for it.
Right.
No. The computers know, or the people watching, or
the cameras. Literally.
That John picked them up, so they were still in John's checkout receipt.
Yes. So even though they left the store in your possession, Violetta, John paid for them?
That's correct.
Wow.
So if you don't sign into the Amazon Go store and you just go with someone...
Who's grabbing what, because the person that grabs it technically is the one that pays for it.
Well, we're learning that in every which way.
We tried to explain it at WGNRadio.com. It's there right now. I'm recommending it. So I'm going to take one more minute of this professor at Hamline University's time to ask him about the Rosenstein story. He told us that the 25th Amendment in this case is virtually not applicable. And it's so complicated to go down that road. But, Dave, just one more question for you then. The president, does he have the right to appoint the new assistant attorney general? We have an attorney general, that's Sessions. Does Sessions appoint that person, or does the president do that?
The president does, subject to confirmation by the Senate.
All right, so assume that he'll get his guy. He could then pick somebody who is predisposed to feel the way he does about the length of or the reach of the Mueller investigation, correct?
Potentially, yes. You know, I say potentially because one would have thought with Jeff Sessions, you know, when he was appointed Attorney General, he would be more likely to do the bidding of Donald Trump. And what he's turned out to be is somebody who is saying that I'm going to maintain the independence of the Attorney General's office, Justice Department, and to make sure we do fair investigations. And I think it's important to understand here because, you know, for some people, who may not like Donald Trump or may say everything is rigged, you know, here's somebody put in office who would expect to do Donald Trump's bidding, and I'm going to go on a limb and say who's doing the right thing, who's saying we're going to do a fair investigation.
Well, I think that's what Mueller is trying to do. I wish it wasn't filled with Democrats, but I think Mueller is, I have no reason to not believe that Mueller isn't trying to do the right thing. But the president wants people that are loyal to him. I cannot imagine he would not screen this next candidate for someone who is not loyal to him and of a like disposition on this thing.
I would presume so also. And now we start to get into a race for the clock here, too. Now, the last that I had heard, since just the last few minutes ago, is that Rosenstein is not out. They have a meeting scheduled for Thursday. Now, it's possible he's fired. It's possible he resigns. It's possible also that he still stays on. You know, we're all speculating at this point. But no matter what happens, especially if he does get ousted, it's going to get caught in the middle of the 2018 elections, and I think that's going to complicate things in terms of finding a replacement, too.
Well, he gets to appoint whoever he wants. I mean, The Senate.
Right, but again, subject to advice and consent from the Senate.
Ah, the Senate folded a long time ago. We don't have a Senate anymore. Somebody this weekend described the United States Senate this way. It is supposed to be the bowl in which the milk cools. The Senate is supposed to be not the House of the People, but the more senior and sedate House, so that if a president wants this or a president wants that, you are not the rubber stamp for the president. You are the place where these things take time. And we make sure that the process is going correctly. In theory, to me, the Senate ought to be able to cool their jets about this thing. I'm speaking now about the new Supreme Court justice. I don't get the feeling that the Senate has that attitude right now.
I absolutely agree on this one. I feel like whatever one may think about Kavanaugh or the accusers, the protocol usually is for FBI investigations to be completed first and for the Senate to take its constitutional role of advice and consent seriously, because we are making somebody an appointment for life. And the way I describe it to my students, the Supreme Court are the trustees for the Constitution. They are the guardians of what our most important legal document says, and you would hope that they would say that before anybody gets on the court for life, that we really are certain that we trust that person's judgment.
Dave Schultz's book is The Presidential Swing States. He's updated it. It's fascinating. If you are interested in this election or the way presidents get elected generally, The Presidential Swing States, which are they? And what does that mean? By David Schultz at Hamline University. We'll visit again, Dave. Thanks for your time.
Thanks to all the people in Chicago. Bye.
He's a Minnesota guy. 146 on WGN. Speaking of presidents, Teddy Roosevelt and I are going to be on stage November 10th. Oh, come to this show. Come to this show. It's going to be at 10:30 in the morning. We're only doing one. It's going to be at Elgin Community College. When Roosevelt comes onto stage, you get a robust, you get a brilliant, funny, cowboy, soldier, scholar, and a man whose character, boy, if we are talking about the character of the people that are running our government these days, then you want Teddy Roosevelt. You want him to come down off of Mount Rushmore and into the mayor's office or the governor's office or the attorney general's office or the president's office or the principal's office. Here's how steadfastly Roosevelt would defend his character, the way he described it at a show last year.
Alice smoked. She smoked, and one day I caught her smoking in the White House kitchen, and I said, "No child of mine will ever smoke in this house." She smoked on the roof. She drank spirituous liquor. Now, I'm a sarsaparilla man myself. I was accused by a newspaper in 1912 of being publicly drunk. It was a labor newspaper, and the editor got a little out of hand during the Bull Moose campaign, and he said, "This Roosevelt, everyone agrees, is often seen drunk publicly." After I lost that race, although it was the most successful third-party candidacy in American history, I decided once and for all to put an end to this rumor that I was drunk. And so I sued the newspaper. And the poor editor just wanted to drop it. I wouldn't let him. And so at $40,000 expense, which would be $500,000 in your time, I assembled this team of everybody who ever knew me. And we came up to Wisconsin. And we had a trial. And they all said, "I've never seen Mr. Roosevelt drink." I made a list of every alcoholic beverage I had ever consumed. Every one, an autobiography of drink. Yes, you should try this. And after all these people gave their depositions, and I remember one of them was asked, "Well, is Mr. Roosevelt publicly drunk?" And he said, "No, he just looks like he's drunk." But after all this, the judge was just this weary little fellow. He just wanted to get it over with. And he said, "I think that all of the character witnesses that you have brought in, Mr. Roosevelt, have adequately proved that this was an irresponsible charge made by this newspaper. Can we stop?" And I said, "No. I want to be on the witness stand myself, and I'm going to tell you every drink that I have ever consumed and where." and I gave a four-hour deposition. And here's why, because I knew that then this would become the historical record, and nobody would ever accuse me of being drunk again, and it hasn't happened. So it's all over now, and the judge is just, he's a spent man, as weary as can be. And he finally said, I'm summarily deciding for you, the plaintiff. Now it's time for damages. We understand that you have spent $40,000 on this trial. You're entitled to relief and other damages that you might specify. What do you now ask the court to do? Do you know what I said? I said, what's the minimal fine? The judge said, 6 cents. I said, that's the fine. Because I didn't want to make this about money, of course. That would be silly. But Alice drank because she knew that I didn't.
It's our Teddy Roosevelt, and he's just one amazing story after another. You'll feel good about the presidency and America when he's on stage. You get to ask questions, too, about life now and life then. Tickets are at WGNradio.com/events. Go to WGNradio.com/events. It says the Blizzard Theater box office is open Monday through Thursday, noon to 6. Call 847-622-0300. It's sponsored by American Sale.
Thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
I thought.
Here's John Williams.
Supposed to be nicer today. But it's cooler anyway. Boy, what a great weekend.
It was just beautiful all weekend. I was in Milwaukee yesterday morning, sitting outside having breakfast. I was a little warm.
Yeah, no kidding. It was kind of warm in the sun on Friday. And then Saturday and Sunday were just delightful. We ask you this news click question at WGNradio.com. It's a daily web poll question that is yet unsponsored. Attention, area businesses. Attach your name to this feature. Producer Aleph, what is the news click, please?
You are Rod Rosenstein. What would you do? A. Quit 10%. B. Wait to be fired 83%. C. Change my identity. Flee the country 7%.
I'm in the 7%.
You have a full passport, a lot of stamps on your passport, because you're leaving for a lot of crimes.
That's my advice to a lot of people that have been charged with crimes these days. They go, it doesn't look good. Just run. Just go. Go, 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 go. We got too many people in this country, evidently, anyway. Just run. Just go. Okay, but 80-some percent was wait to be fired. Wait to be fired as opposed to quit. He is still the assistant attorney general, as you just heard. It's an interesting issue that they had in Time magazine a couple of issues ago, and I've been meaning to bring it up. We did on Saturday and got a lot of comment about it, and I thought I would just fly it in front of you today. Their teacher issue was all about issues involving teachers, and then they had a photo essay in the middle where they showed the second jobs that teachers have. Teachers are famous for having second jobs because generally they have the summer off, and generally they're not that well paid. Brian Davis is a middle school geography teacher in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. He makes $42,000 a year. He's also a private softball coach where he earns $25 per lesson on the side. He's also an Uber driver, so he has three jobs. Matesha Olson, 45, same town in Oklahoma, is a middle school English teacher. She makes $40,000 a year. She drives the school bus to make $17.60 an hour. Elementary school teacher Tracy Deegan in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, makes $80,000 a year. Tracy is also an oyster farmer and makes $15 an hour. Chris Wilson is 36, is a high school history teacher in Houston, Texas, and makes $56,000 a year. He also works at Barnes & Noble, 20 hours a week for $11.75 an hour. I know so many people who aren't teachers, too, and have nice jobs or, you know, jobs where they're working in an office or, you know, something or another, doing all kinds of things. And they have insurance and they're on salary. And then you bump into them at a store and, you know, they're wearing a T-shirt with the company's name on it. You realize they work there. You remember when you were a kid and you'd see your teacher at the mall just shopping. And that was shocking because it's hard to imagine their lives outside the classroom. It's the same sort of thing when, as an adult, you find one of your colleagues has a second job. or a third job. You know, as a broadcaster, I've at times had two jobs too. Some people are doing it because they want to throw away a little cash or save for college or a vacation. And some people are doing it because that's what you have to do these days. I ain't knocking the economy. I mean, it is what it is. If you're lucky enough to have a 401k, and most people aren't, it's doing pretty well. Hopefully your pension is doing well. And hopefully you've been able to find a job now. And wages, they say, are going up. But I know a lot of people who work two jobs. And I'm wondering what that second job or your side hustle is. By the way, doesn't side hustle sound more like a hobby that you're cashing in on? A side hustle doesn't sound so bad. A side hustle is something you do. Hey, it's you're creative, you're clever, you figured something out, and now you're making a little money.
You're parking cars in your driveway for the
exactly.
Sox game.
Exactly. The guy with $40, that's a side hustle. But the person who is, in fact, greeting you at Walmart and is also working Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, but now they're doing that on nights and weekends, that ain't no side hustle. So I'm wondering what that second job is that you have. And my number is 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Tell me what it is. Have you had two jobs? Do you have two jobs right now? I'd be curious to know. I'll tell you, we got a lot of calls and texts over the weekend about that. One guy said his mom is 71 years old, and she has a full-time job and a part-time job. She is 71. Here again, everybody's got their own story, right? Some people are working still because they still want to work. But that's not the case, I don't think, for everybody. Corey Haney, Houston, Texas, 25, middle school teacher, makes $58,000 a year. And then at $38 an hour is a choreographer at Living Lines Dance Studio. Megan McMillan, 38, is a teacher in high school. She's a freshman leadership teacher. She makes $51,000 a year. She works at PetSmart for $9.25 an hour. Okay, your story's next. 312-981-7200. Hey, John, if teachers don't like their page, then they can quit complaining and find another job. Well, we knew we'd get that one, right? Anytime you say, well, the teachers have it easy or hard, then somebody else says, well, they have the summer off, or nobody works harder than teachers. There's no way to have that conversation without somebody reminding us of one of those points.
Nobody works harder than teachers, and they've got the summer off and a few weeks at Christmas and an Easter break, and yeah. It can all be true.
Right, and they really work hard, and they don't get paid that well. Or you know,
sometimes they get paid very well.
It depends on the teacher and the school district.
It really does.
It really does. Some teachers in the South, Southeast, they don't get paid much at all. And then some of them in LaGrange make a lot of money.
Where was it? Was it in Oklahoma where they had the long sort of protest over the summer or last spring? Where they had to have second jobs.
And I think a lot of them, so now we need to define what a good job or a lot of money is. But a lot of them are making more than the median, if that's $60,000 in Illinois. And I think it's just under $60,000. John, my husband is a 60-year-old retired teacher who still subs and works at Home Depot. My daughter's a high school chemistry teacher. She makes $51,000 a year. She coaches two seasons of track and swimming at the YMCA after that. Hey, John, I am 70 years old. I work three jobs. John, my funeral director, side hustle, rural county coroner. I'm not exactly sure what that means. Funeral director, side hustle.
So he's a funeral director and also the county coroner.
I see. Well, John, we went from single source of income to double, and it's still not enough. It's Pottersville for many, 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 says 312. Nick, you're on WGN. Jump on there, Nick. We're talking about second jobs and how folks are making ends meet. What did you want to say? You're on the air.
Hey, John. I just want to say I'm a construction worker by day, and then at night I also do the Amazon delivery driving as well.
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, I'm sorry for you if you really have to work really hard two jobs to make ends meet, but they are subbing a lot of that out to independent people like you. Do you make much money doing that?
You know what? It comes out to be $18 an hour, so it's easier than looking for a part-time job in a store somewhere, and you pick and choose when you want to work. So overall, I'd recommend it if you can get in.
And then, that's for who are you doing that for? For Amazon?
Amazon.
Yeah. Yeah. Really interesting. Hey, thank you for calling. Thank you for listening. Take it easy, Nick. We'll go from you to Matt. You're on WGN. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hey, John. I'm calling from Sandwich, Illinois. I think you know where that's at.
I live there in beautiful Sandwich, Illinois. What's your deal, man?
So, did a startup because there were no jobs when the market fell apart. And it's now the fifth fastest growing company in the state of Illinois. But guess what? I'm not the owner of the company. So I also run a farm with cattle and beans and corn, which you probably know quite a bit about.
So you farm and you have an office job as well?
Correct, in Naperville. Yep.
Yeah. So how do you feel about that? Like, are you happy to have two incomes, or do you think this sucks, I've got to work two jobs? What's your head about all of that?
I think it's a really strange dichotomy. So, I mean, I'm techie on one side and covered with cow
manure,
you know, on the other side. So, yeah, it's interesting. I'm either covered with grease or just...
You're just itching to say it, aren't you? All right, Matt, listen, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. My best to you over there. What'd you say, Ms. Garris? Mine, too, is Dave. Hey, Dave, you're on WGN Radio. Jump in there. You're on the air.
Yeah, about teachers. The teachers that I know are now retired, but they work their whole lives doing it. It's not an eight-hour job. The 9 months that you say that they're working, it might be 12-hour days. They're grading papers, setting up lesson plans, even doing things on weekends, trying to get stuff ready for the next week. They don't get the whole summer off. They're mostly coming in August to set up classrooms, projects, yep. Classroom size, realize where these kids are coming from. I mean, they have to do, like, a profile, figure out who's where and, you know, which group needs help. I mean, classrooms are divided by a third. I mean, you got the ones that are going to make it, the ones that need some help, and the ones that need all the help. So it's, and, you know, their pay just does not match with everything that they have to do.
I'm glad you're listening, and I'm glad you called. Thanks, Dave. We're going to go from you to Jim. You're on WGN. Hey, Jim, you're on the air.
Hey, John. Good to talk to you.
Yeah.
How are you today?
I'm super totally groovy. What do you want to say?
Well, I've worked as a teacher. I'm retired. I'm 61. I was a junior high teacher for 30-something years, and I worked as a bartender and a waiter part-time almost that whole career. And now I'm actually a junior college teacher, and I still am bartending and waiting on tables.
Why do you do that?
You know, I have two kids in college. And you know, paying for sports and things for my kids over the years, that just helped supplement it. And at the time, I was married, and my wife stayed home with the kids and didn't work, so needed the extra money.
Yeah.
And I hope to keep doing it till I'm 70 or 75.
Well, you know, if you
can... Because I like working, too, though.
Well, I think there's that, too. I mean, I think some people work because they don't want to stop working. But I think the conversation we're mostly having here, though, Jim, is... People are doing this because they really need to. If you want to put your kids through college or help them get through college, you're not doing your kids any favor if when they graduate, they've got $85,000 of debt. If you want to give them a hand, you got to get an extra job for a lot of folks.
That's what I'm doing. I'm trying to help them. So
hang in there, buddy. Thanks for the call.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
312-981-7200. You can text to us as well. Nikki is on line one. All right, are we going to take line one next or no? Line one, yes? Okay. Hey, Nikki, you're on WGN. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi. I was a school teacher for 25 years, and I was lucky enough to have a husband that worked full time. So I didn't personally have to get a second job or even a third job. But I know many of my colleagues, especially if they were single, would have to do that in order to make ends meet. And the amount of money, before my school year would start, I know I was putting out $250 to $300 to make sure that I had notebooks and pencils and things for the kids because some of them just couldn't afford it. Where I taught and where they taught, you know, it's sometimes a very hard thing to be a teacher, but yet it's very rewarding when you hear about the fact that you have students that have become lawyers or doctors or... you know, have done well, and you want to think that you've had just a minute of their time to help make them the person that they were.
By the way, were you able to deduct your supplies that you paid for in the classroom?
Not in the beginning. I'm over in Indiana, and not in the beginning, but then it got to a point where there something came in. It was like $250 for the year, and that was like virtually nothing. Because
I thought that the new tax bill said that teachers could deduct their school supplies. Which
well,
they should.
I've been retired for 4 years now, and I know it was for a while. It was like $250 was the max that we could take.
Yeah,
and I know that again, you know, it's sometimes you would have to do it on the sly so that the children didn't feel embarrassed because they couldn't afford what some of their colleagues, you know, their fellow classmates could.
Right. So you were buying it for them,
and
I know, slipping it to them.
Yeah, I know, and sometimes my students would. You know, they would say to me, Mrs. Williams, can I borrow, you know, $2 or $3? And I would tell them no because I'm not a bank, but I would give it to them. But then they would have to make some time to come in and basically work it off, like in whether it was cleaning the board or emptying the garbage cans or whatever, because I told them I'm not a bank.
Well, that's well put. Nikki, you sound like you are, always will be a good teacher. Thanks for the call. Lots of texts. John, I own a small business, employ two people. I pick up animal droppings before work to keep the lights on. Are they telling me that that's a job? Or is that just something the person does?
That's a job.
I mean, it's a service.
A pooper picker-upper is a job?
Yeah.
I believe that. I think I've heard of that. So you go to people's yards, right? And you pick it up for them?
Yeah.
Well, you know you've got... You know you have discretionary income when you're paying somebody to do that. What else? John, I'm a suburban firefighter. I make $140,000 a year, and I am working side menial jobs to make ends meet. John, I am a personal banker and ably make $34,000 annually, barely getting by. Will never be able to retire. That's the thing. I see so many people who have jobs these days, and I think this job cannot be paying a lot of money. I'm glad you got a job, but I know a lot of people are still working two-plus jobs just to try and make ends meet. John, I'm soon to be 67-year-old male in the construction field, currently working three jobs, one full-time, two part-time, all construction-related, trying to get caught up from the last recession. You hang in there, Dan. Thanks for the text. Quick texts include, John, my husband and I barely make $74,000 a year. If you can't make it on 80, you need a new plan. From 630, teachers are overpaid if you include their pensions. This one says from 708, so anybody who doesn't think they get paid well enough as a teacher should quit and find another job, then you have a teacher shortage problem. This isn't the answer either. But from 630, lots of teachers retire at 55, and retirement is way over $80,000 a year. That's not bad at all. Not all retired teachers are making $80,000 a year, but I get the point that some people will teach for 30 years, retire relatively young, you know, 55, and then have another job. They're pulling the pension and still making some extra income. I know you were busy this summer. You did projects, the kids, you traveled a little. What did you do this summer? And you didn't just take the time to fix that knee pain you've been suffering from. And now here it is fall. We got football games to go to and leaves to rake and tailgates to attend, and that knee's bothering you still. Don't have that kind of autumn. I want you to go to the Joint Relief Institute in Orland Park. That's where I went. They're really good at what they do there. They use digital imaging to see where your knee is failing you. They put a joint lubricant into that spot. They are careful. They are compassionate. They're really good at this, and it works. Your insurance will almost certainly pay for it, too. You got nothing to lose in all of fall in front of you. So call this number, 708-888-0000. 708, that's Orland Park. 888, think ache, 0000, as in zero pain. WGN Radio News is sponsored by CMEGroup.com. We'll visit with Philip Bump from the Washington Post and talk just a little bit more about the Rod Rosenstein story. Rod Rosenstein story in 30 seconds, Steve. I just wanted to mention, because so many of you have taken the time to text to us such heartfelt stories. like this from 708. John, I was molested as an adult. Obviously, we're talking about the Kavanaugh story and these stories of sexual assault that women have had to endure over the years. 708 says, John, I was molested as an adolescent. I did not report it. If I found out that that person was running for office, would I report it now or speak up? I didn't report it because I just wanted the situation to end. John, I'm 51-year-old woman, and I get really angry when women don't look out for each other. If I'm attacked and I don't tell authorities, that man can go on and attack others. I will bear a degree of responsibility. From 847, John, when a man was abused by a priest 30 years ago, oh, it's the poor man. A woman gets abused, she must be lying. 708 says, John, when I was 16, a policeman raped me, and I never spoke about it to anyone until this year, and I'm 70. On her deathbed, my sister told me that our uncle molested her when she was 8 years old. She never spoke about it until she was dying. We bury this stuff deep in our hearts, and I don't really expect you men to understand, but I do expect them to believe me because I have nothing to gain and only pain by speaking of it now. How women can defend a man who is accused and condemn a woman who tells her story is beyond my comprehension. You can always text to 312-981-7200. We appreciate your thoughts. We'll follow this story. Philip Bump joins us on WGN Radio, the national correspondent for the Washington Post. Nice to talk to you again, Philip. How are you this afternoon?
I'm well, thank you.
We're talking about the Rod Rosenstein story with you. What's happened today on this?
It's a great question, and the long story short is that Rod Rosenstein is, as he was a week ago at this time, the Deputy Attorney General of the United States. There was a report this morning that the Post confirmed that he had offered his resignation following that report on from the New York Times last week suggesting that he had expressed some serious concerns about Donald Trump's competency shortly after James Comey was fired last year. But it appears that that resignation has not yet been accepted by the White House, that he and President Trump will meet on Thursday to have some sort of conversation. We're not sure what that's going to look like. And at that point, who knows? He may or may not still be in his position.
But he denied it, and the president dismissed it as fake news. So if it's just the New York Times being bad or Washington Post getting it wrong, then why does Rosenstein have to leave?
Referring, I assume, to the story from last Friday about his concerns about Trump, I think that his denial was pretty broad and left some room for some interpretation of what he might have said that was reflected accurately in the reporting.
Go ahead. Keep going, Phil.
I was just going to say, clearly he has had tension with President Trump for an extended period of time, in part stemming from the Russia investigation. So I think that he's been in a difficult and perhaps untenable position for quite some time. This may have been the straw that broke the camel's back.
Okay, but it still makes me wonder if, even in jest, he said that. But we noticed when he first started to deny the New York Times reporting that his denial wasn't unequivocal. It was interestingly worded, like the report wasn't accurate, which doesn't, entirely dismiss everything that's in it at the same time, does it?
Right, yeah. And the Washington Post confirmed aspects of the Times story, and obviously we stand by our reporting. So, and I think that the developments of the day, to your point, reinforce the idea that this was a point of tension between himself and the president.
Okay, so maybe it's the straw that broke the camel's back. But just to be clear then, are we all settled that he did, at least in jest, kid about invoking the 25th Amendment? He really didn't mean it, but that was just enough for the president to say, that's it, I'm going to remove the stench of the Department of Justice, right?
Well, the president's argument about the stench, which he made in the campaign rally in Missouri on Friday night, that really is, I think, broader than just Rosenstein. I mean, certainly the Rosenstein thing undoubtedly got under his skin. You know, again, the Post stands by reporting that there were these conversations, the extent to which they were in jest is sort of hard to articulate or to elucidate. But the stench question, Trump is really referring broadly to his suggestion that the Department of Justice has been out to get him with the the Russia investigation. He's referring to Andrew McCabe's firing, the former deputy director at the FBI. He's referring certainly to the firing of James Comey. He's referring to these two FBI employees who had these text messages in which they disparaged him. There's this entire universe of conspiracy theories wrapped around what the Department of Justice has done, that Trump supports, that Fox News has been bolstering. And I think that's really what Trump was referring to more directly than the Rosenstein issue.
A little surprised he's waiting even this long. You know, Comey found out via text when he was standing in front of a crowd. I wonder what the president's play is. What's he waiting for?
It's a good question. I think part of it is that Rosenstein has done a decent job of actually maintaining a decent relationship with the president. There certainly are ways in which Rosenstein acts as sort of an intermediary between Robert Mueller and the real world, and by which I mean that if Robert Mueller wanted to indict someone, he has to get that cleared by Rosenstein. So it's not really clear what might have happened had Rosenstein not been in this current position that might have reflected unfavorably upon President Trump. For example, Donald Trump Jr., there's a lot of speculation he might be indicted. Perhaps this is something where Rosenstein intervened. It's hard to say what the full extent of that relationship looks like. But that said, it certainly is the case that Donald Trump would like to see this investigation either ended or wrapped up quickly, and Rosenstein is in a position to do that.
He's not firing the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, though. Would you just speak about that? I mean, you know, the world would fall down if he had fired Jeff Sessions, but it's Rosenstein that's overseeing the Mueller investigation. Isn't this rather seismic if he releases him?
It is. But there's a lot of complexity to sort of the chain of command there. So if, for example, President Trump were to fire Jeff Sessions, which it's rumored he's planning on doing after the midterm elections, if he were to do that, there could be a new attorney general appointed who then would assume control for the Russian investigation. The only reason it's in Rosenstein's camp, and the only reason he's dealing with that, is because Sessions had recused himself in March of last year because Sessions was involved in Trump's campaign. So therefore, Justice Department officials said, hey, you can't be involved in decision-making around this because it's an investigation that essentially looks at something you were involved in. So Sessions recuses himself. Rosenstein's in charge of it. But if Sessions is gone and a new attorney general comes in, then that person would take or assume responsibility for the investigations. Likewise, if Rosenstein leaves, someone else, and specifically Noel Francisco, the Solicitor General, would take over the Russia investigation. However, and this is an important caveat, if Sessions or Rosenstein resign, then Trump can take anyone else who's been approved by the Senate during his administration and slot them in automatically into those roles without Senate confirmation. So he could, for example, take Rick Perry out of the Department of Energy and make him Deputy Attorney General, and then Rick Perry could essentially cripple the Mueller investigation fairly easily. So there's a lot of nuance to how these positions go unfilled, how the people leave their roles that affects what happens to the Mueller investigation.
I want to be clear about that, too. So you're saying that if he dismisses, if he fires Rosenstein, he can replace Rosenstein, Sessions doesn't, and it does not require Senate confirmation?
No, it's a great question, and I may have explained it poorly. So the difference is between firing and resigning. There's a thing called the Vacancies Reform Act of 1998. If Donald Trump fires an employee, It is not the case he can just pull someone from another Senate-approved position and slot them into that same position. It's questionable. It's not clear in the law. However, if the person resigns, it's very clear. He can absolutely take someone else and replace them. So if Rosenstein resigns, it's very easy for Donald Trump to put someone in there who agrees with his worldview on the Russia investigation nearly instantaneously, which I think he would see as a benefit.
But if he fires him, it may be more complicated, and it might require congressional approval.
That's exactly right. If he fires them, then either he would try and replace them, in which case it would probably be fought to the Supreme Court as to whether or not he has the right to do that, or he would have to get Senate confirmation, which would obviously mean the Senate could exercise leverage over, you know, if this is someone who's actually going to end the Mueller investigation.
Well, the plot thickens then, doesn't it? Because, you know, we have a daily web poll question, Philip, and today it is, our news click is, would you quit or would you wait to be fired? That's not a trivial question now, is it? Because if Rosenstein wants to make his legacy the integrity of the Mueller investigation, then he's going to wait to be fired and force the president to get Senate approval.
That's exactly right. And that's why this question of him having offered his resignation and the White House having potentially rejected it, at least for the short term, is so fascinating. Because it seems contrary to what Rosenstein would want to do in that circumstance.
Yeah. Well, I have an expression. It's called, I got quit. And that's when somebody says, I quit, because you don't want to suffer maybe the humiliation of being fired. But in this case, it might be the flip of that. Better you be fired than you quit, because A, you want to force the president's hand, and B, you want to make sure that he can't just put Eric in charge of the Mueller investigation if he wants.
Right. Yeah, that's, I mean, Eric's not a great example simply because he's not Senate confirmed. It has to be someone who's Senate confirmed already for a position. Right. But whatever. Again, we're getting pretty far down the rabbit hole here.
Anything else we need to know then about where we are today? We're going to have to wait and see, I guess. Anything else on this front?
I think it's just important for folks to realize that that Robert Mueller is obviously very aware of all these machinations. He's investigating the president for potential obstruction of justice, looking at how the president may have tried to tie his hands. And so Robert Mueller may have some cards up his sleeve. I've spoken with experts who say that, you know, if someone who's antagonistic to the investigation gets in charge of it, they can do a lot of things like end the grand jury, drop existing charges, prevent Mueller from filing any indictments. So we've seen in the past Mueller do things like farm stuff out to the Southern District in New York U.S. Attorney, like the Michael Cohen investigation. There are ways in which he can protect the work that he's doing, and we're not really clear yet on how he might have done that either.
That's a fascinating notion, too. Read Philip Bump in the Washington Post. They have a print edition. They're online, too. If you do not already, today would be a good day to subscribe to a newspaper, and I subscribe to the Washington Post. I appreciate your time, Philip, and we'll visit with you again.
Thank you very much.
Philip Bump is the national correspondent at WAPO. It's 2:50. Rokon and Advantis aren't too far away. We'll check in with them in a few. Kavanaugh letter to Chairman Grassley and the ranking member Feinstein. I'm looking at it now. There it is, Brent M. Kavanaugh, the signature at the end. This letter was posted today. When I testified in front of the Senate 3 weeks ago, I explained my belief that the process is foundational to justice and to our democracy. And then he goes on to say things like, these smears against me, this is Kavanaugh writing, these are smears, pure and simple. As I told the committee during my hearing, a federal judge must be independent, not swayed by public or political pressure. That's the kind of judge I will always be. I will not be intimidated into withdrawing from this process. The coordinated effort to destroy my good name will not drive me out. The vile threats of violence against my family will not drive me out. The last-minute character assassination will not succeed. You know what I also think is possible? It's about Brett. It's about Dr. Ford. It's about all of the people that knew them. It's about all of the people who were at the party. What you do and don't remember may be different than what happened or what I do or don't remember. There's only three people, the way I understand the story, who know exactly what happened. So if he gets 1,000 women to sign a letter saying this is not the man we knew, unless all 1,000 of them were in the room that night, they don't know. People of great character are capable of really stupid and criminal things at other times in their life. I don't understand how that's all piling up against her. And the flip is true, too. She can get all of the character witnesses she wants, but there's only three people that know what happened. Judge Kavanaugh and Blasey Ford. Story moves on. We'll continue to follow it here on WGN Radio. There I was, just trying to watch football games this weekend. Never before have I been more clicker challenged. Kevin, you're in sports, right? So what were you doing yesterday? Were you watching Tiger, Cubs, Sox, Vikings, or Packers? Two great games, two really interesting teams for us that were on at the same time. And the Yankees were also on, I think, TBS. What were you watching yesterday?
I was watching it all, John. I really was. I was soaking it all in. It was just an outstanding sports Sunday.
Hard to click away from Tiger. Hard to click away from that.
Yeah, you know, I was at the Cubs Sox game. We were sitting in the press box. Fortunately, the Sox in the press box, there's about 15 TVs. So the Cubs pretty much had that game in hand early on. So we had six TVs in the middle. It was Tiger to the right. We had two TVs dedicated to Cubs White Sox. To the left, we had football. Then the Bears started. And some members of the media late in that Cubs Sox game, which was sort of dragging, not the most exciting game of them all. But
right,
we were huddled around just watching Tiger. And we were watching the Bears, and
I was amazed.
People had popcorn watching that game in Arizona, and one of the members of the media walked by, and she was like, definitely a Bears town.
I know. Sox, Cubs, and you're all watching TV.
It was just so much good stuff yesterday.
Well, the Vikings game and the Packers game were really interesting games to us, but Lord, did the Vikings suck it up. I didn't know they were that bad. And you know, the Packers almost made a run, but they didn't win that game either.
You know, through 3 weeks, John, this is a reminder. Everything the NFL's gone through over the past few years with concussions and Kaepernick and this and that, the past 2-3 weeks in the NFL has reminded all of us why NFL is king. It is unpredictable every single week, and anybody can beat anybody.
There's
and
parody.
It is so much fun. There's parody. You know, the NBA, it's 3 or 4 teams. We know who's going to win the championship. The NFL, there are probably, you can name 6, 7, 8 teams that probably have a decent shot at winning the Super Bowl, and nobody thought the Bills were going to do what they did at Minnesota yesterday.
Well, or how many people predicted last night's game? Did you think that New England was going to lose to, Buffalo?
To Detroit.
To Detroit
who was 0-2. Yeah, the Lions looked awful. it was just a great sports week. The NFL has been great through 3 weeks. I'm a little bit giddy here in the sports office today, John. I'm a little pumped up here. Bears are in first place, by the way. Has anybody missed that?
Coming up, the stories that matter with Judy Pilak from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio. Ro and Anna will say hi. Ro and Anna are in Studio A. Hi, kids. How are you?
Hi there, John. Happy Monday.
Couldn't be better. I don't want to talk about the news here first.
Yeah.
I just want to talk about a perfect Sunday of sports.
Man. Oh, yeah.